anybody ever turns out the Department of State to be postmaster?
Recognizing that there's a significant other wedding at the border,
lots of
get started and try to run only about 15 minutes or more longer, because I have spent a longer session than typically would have. But Steve, yeah, please.
I have a question. I'm not sure I can ask it in as succinct or as pointed a way as I'd like. Of course, we love the stories you were telling about your worst situation and all of that. But if you just add up the stories, it sounds like you're dealing with 500 and 35 prima donnas, people who have an exaggerated sense of their own importance. Number one, is that really true? And number two, if it is, do you deal with them any differently than you deal with normal human beings?
Spoken as a presidential scholar, not a congressional scholar.
I see.
Well, I would answer that in that I think the Congress is as diverse as the American population. You have people with all kind of good motivations, venal motivations. You have optimists, pessimists. You have honest people. You have crooks. You have it runs the whole gamut, but they all have one thing in common. The thing that is the most prevalent on their mind is the next election and whether they're going to be reelected. I would say for 99% of them that's true, unless they've announced their retirement or for some reason they're going to leave the Congress. But the thing I always tried to keep in mind was this person is motivated by he wants to stay in Congress. And when he does this or he does that, for the reason to advance his reelection. Anybody that runs for public office and attains public office successfully, I think has to have an ego. I have known very few members of Congress or Senate that haven't had a massive to monster ego. I think that's part of the reason that they're in the Congress. They're are in politics because they crave attention, and you have some of them that are motivated by public service, but even those that I've known, they're still tremendous ego. So I think they are a breed apart. They are people that are usually highly intelligent, although there's exceptions to that. But they generally are generally intelligent, above average probably. They're people that have been successful in their life, and they're people that love being in the public eye. And I would find them a little bit different than the average. You can't treat them like you would the average individual, where you talk about your interests and they talk about theirs. With them, it's all their interest. I mean, they are in a situation where they need constant care and feeding and maintenance.
Isn't it just like the academy?
No, I'm just kidding, Steve.
there are some
only at Georgetown.
No, having been a member.
Not at UVA.
Having been a former Board of Regents member, I just wanted to throw that out. No.
I've got one exception. And it's only one. I agree with everything Max said. I was at a reception up on the hill, and I wanted to meet a member very early in my career, maybe 2 or 3 weeks. It was a congressman from Chicago. He said, come over here, I'm going to tell you something. He said, I can save you some time. He said, Mayor Daley sent me here. He said, I have a tavern at home. I was happy serving in Springfield. And he said, all you have to do is just ask Frank Annunzio how he's going to vote, and that'll be the way I vote.
Josh, that one up.
That's 2-4-1. He said, I always vote the way Frank tells me. So that's the only exception. He didn't want to be there. He wanted to be back at his tavern. But Mayor Daley had sent him.
Sent him over, yeah.
Yep.
See, I reflect 17 years on the Hill and 3 in the White House. And the one thing I think, you know, distinguishes them, not so much that they've got the next election on their mind, but they've been elected. Yeah. All of us, important jobs, we've got important decisions and advice from the president. We were never on a ballot.
That's right.
And I can, you know, I've been part of this with telling stories. My boss, another Chicago member, not the one clearly you're talking about, because he was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, at a budget meeting, looking around, say, would staff leave the room? And looked at the president's chief of staff and said, I said, staff, leave the room. I mean, we have important jobs, and he didn't leave the room, and they laughed, and it was okay. He was able to stay. They got elected. We play roles, and we can debate whether or not there should be more of us or fewer of us, or, you know, it's changed over time. But, you know, those men and women, without that, there's nothing. Give me back to the legislative component of the research.
I'd like to follow up on Chuck Brain's astonishing story.
Excuse me, didn't you have a comment?
Well, I just want to say I do think there could be an interesting study of presidents over time that have relied on personal relationships with key members of Congress. And I think we all, when we're over there in this position, we wonder where all those fine members are. And at least looking historic at the composition of the Congress, Max is correct. But I do think that in the age of television and the bloody combat of political campaigns today, that clearly deters a lot of fine people from seeking public office who might otherwise do so. And financial disclosure rules and a whole host of other things. And one sees that in the composition of the Congress, especially when the divisions are so close between the parties. So I think that your characterization of regarding 535 prima donnas, I don't quite see it that way, but I think the demands on elective office today are just so much greater than they were, and the costs that those seeking office have to pay are so huge, and those who are willing to have their reputations assaulted as they are today in campaigns are getting to be fewer and fewer. But that's not a presidential issue, that's just an observation. I don't know, I thought, Frank is from Georgia, if Dick Russell had run for the Senate today, I don't know that he could win an election in Georgia. He wasn't very good on TV.
He wasn't very good at shaking hands.
He wasn't very, you know.
I don't think Walter George could.
Who, Frank?
Walter George. He couldn't win, Josh.
John?
Chuck told an amazing story about a member of Congress who had to be coached in how to shake down the president. And I would expect that more often it goes the other way, that members come naturally to this. And one of your jobs must be to discern when it's authentic and when it's not. And I wonder if how you do that, and also what happens when you try and stare down a member and refuse to cave in because you think he'll have to vote with you anyhow.
I think we've all, our friends have made reference to sort of the chain of no's, you know, running it up. I cut off the yes at a lower level than he did. I figured my staff was to say no, and I got to say yes. Fred moved it up higher, which is great. That is an inherent winnowing out process. If it's really important to you, you keep going. If it isn't, okay, fine. You'll take a no and go away. So if it's that big a deal, they'll keep pushing. They'll figure out a way. Part of it is, you know, what can they do, you know, if they are mad? What can they do, to retaliate? If you're looking at a member of the opposite party who's going to vote against you on everything anyway, probably never going to do anything for you, it gets easy. If it's a powerful member of the opposing party, okay, it depends on when we'll have something in front of him. If it's a friend of the president, again, I'm describing a minority Democrat, minority member, but friend of the president, stuck by him. Okay, we'll take care of it. So it's it's a way, how it's important to them, and then, you know, what can they do if the answer is no?
I'd just say some of them are just really good at it too. I mean,
it's usually the same one.
Yeah, it's the ones that are smart and you like, but they just know, I need something for my state, so I'm not going to declare early. I'm going to see how this goes. I'm going to see, you know, a couple of my favorite senators. They're the best at this, and love them both. But they just know how to wait it out and how to position themselves, and so that they can ask for a little something. But ultimately, the judgment comes down to understanding their interest and their predicament, which is, is this BS or is this, a critical thing to their base, is really sort of what it comes down to. And you either can or cannot do it for them often. So
yeah. You have to do an assessment of what it is they want to sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can adapt it a little bit and give it to them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's so over the top that there's just no way in the world you can do it,
On this point, isn't there some variation depending on whether the person's chairman of the appropriations committee, like Bird or Stevens? That's an important point. People that have power don't need to ask, so they don't ask.
No. Sometimes they need to ask. I mean, but when those people call, typically they get what they want. I mean, I think it's the fact of the matter. There are occasions, I guess, when they've asked too much, but
Bird, on a legislative matter, appropriate, Bird doesn't need to talk to us. I remember sitting around.
But there are times when he has.
Bird did something last night. We object to it's stuck in an appropriations bill. You can tell him he has to drop it.
But we
I
look.
Said
we,
no. But on other things, we have resources.
Hey, you remember mountaintop removal? Sure, we blocked him. We had
temporarily.
He never got it. I think the judge.
Address.
Yeah. Oh well, maybe I don't know whether he subsequently got it, but I mean, it was extremely difficult. It was extremely. We didn't have much choice. What he was asking was almost unachievable. So.
Sid, Max rightly pointed out that the leading priority of the job is to pass the president's program. But another important part of legislative liaison work, I think, which I'm very interested in, is nominations. And judicial nominations, of course, have become extremely controversial. And I wonder if any of you guys had anything that you might relate to us about your experiences in those kind of contests.
Pray that the court lives. Wait, I'll do the easy one. When I was special assistant, Rehnquist was promoted to chief, and I ended up getting Scalia, which is probably one of the easiest confirmations in modern history of confirmation. I don't think he answered any question that was ever asked of him during the entire process, and so he sort of set one standard, which is the Scalia standard, and in future Supreme Court nominations, members of the Senate would say, well, we're not going to let him get away with what Scalia got away with. So that's sort of like where Scalia is. I also, in my tenure in this job that we're talking about, had both Souter and Thomas, both of whom got confirmed, but under totally different circumstances. then you just pray that they all live forever and never retire, because that can consume a lot of time and be a diversion away from the president's agenda. Alternatively, it creates an opportunity for members of Congress to promote their agenda in the context of a judicial nomination, which is exactly what we see today, which is not any different from the way it's been, I would say, at least going back to the 80s. Will had a different experience.
Well, it's difficult to generalize about in the Senate's, this goes to the core of the whole broader issues affecting the Senate's ability to act, and so I think it's, but the confirmation process clearly has become more of a focal point of disagreement between the parties, and is It's just not working. I was there during a very difficult time. President Reagan nominated Judge Bork, and the Senate had recently shifted from Republican control to Democratic control. And there were just not enough Republicans. Though Judge Bork got his vote, and his nomination didn't go to the floor. But the analysis of that vote's not really pertinent to this discussion, but I just think that the edges that are within the Judiciary Committee and within the Senate as a whole on this issue have become much, much sharper since then. There's far less room for the president of either party to maneuver, and I think it's making it much more difficult, of course, to recruit, again, men and women of goodwill to serve on the bench in any capacity and at any level. Though there's a lot cited in the Bork fight over the precedents that were set during that debate, he faced a Judiciary Committee that was narrowly divided, was opposed by the one conservative Democrat on the committee, Howell Heflin, and then that made it impossible to get the Southern Democrats who had voted in favor of Rehnquist 18 months before, and that was the, with the Republicans then being in the minority, that was a result of that. That was the reason for the effort.
I think there's another reason. You can't get good people. And it's even when a judicial nomination is non-controversial, because the clearance process takes so long with the FBI and the IRS, and they also will get tangled up in another package deal.
Right.
I mean, maybe everybody agrees that this judge would go straight through the Judiciary Committee, recommend. Now, they don't have any votes, but they're sort of held hostage to someone else. And I'm not an attorney, many of you all are, but I've had these guys tell me, I want you to take my name down because it's killing my law practice. I said, well, how'd you gonna be a judge? He said, yeah, but the FBI is going around talking to my elementary school teacher, you know, and they say, what have you done? You know, of course, you can't tell anybody you're gonna be nominated. You know? Can't tell anybody because it's not done yet. And the FBI comes to town, starts asking around, and it ruins their law practice.
That isn't just true of judges, though.
The
FBI check goes to, judges are probably the highest tier problem, but let's face it, the whole nomination process.
Oh, yeah, it's not just judges.
It's everybody. And it has.
And you drag on and on and on.
Everyone's connected to everyone else. It doesn't have anything to do with the quality of the individual. You can be nailed for ancillary reasons. You can be nailed by someone who you don't even know is nailing you. Someone can do a three-corner billiard shot and ask another senator to nail this guy so that he doesn't have to admit that he's nailing him. It has grown really, really, really tough. And
on top of that, it's difficult to find out who's doing the nail.
That's true. Holds in the senator's secret. I frequently have had to call up both cloakrooms and say, all right, who's doing it? You know? and then that's preliminary to trying to figure out why, which can take another 2 weeks. So.
One thing, judicial nominations, though, are the only one, at least, I may be wrong, but I think they are the ones that have attracted organized opposition, television, newspaper ads. That really began, the Bork nomination was one of the first exposed to an organized effort.
Haynesworth.
I think that it obviously has an awful lot to do with the president's popularity and clout. I know when I was there during the Nixon administration, we were in the midst of Watergate and Vietnam, and you couldn't get anybody confirmed, no matter how well qualified, because The Hill was trying to embarrass the president and defeat him on every issue. That was the Haynesworth, Carswell, debacle area, era. Contrast that, when Reagan came in, he came down to Washington about 2 weeks after the election, and he had his nominees named between Thanksgiving and Christmas, and he wanted to try and get the cabinet confirmed by inaugural, and that gave us 3 weeks, and we had every one of them confirmed by inauguration, which is, that's a monumental task. Mm-hmm. The Congress wasn't around. A lot of them were on travel. We had to take those nominees all over the country to meet some of the congressmen or some of the senators. It was just the fact that he came in with a big mandate and he had some time there to work. But I think the farther we went into the Reagan years, it became more difficult as you lose your clout.
Consultation is so important. I'm not going to mention any names. We got some people, I'd say we're marginally qualified for some regulatory commissions, but but if you just take them around, you meet and talk and talk and talk and back around, not just the courtesy visits, but you know, then whiz right on through. I'm thinking of one in particular, Dan Tate had to handle. He said, if you give any more fools like this, I'm going to quit. Dan told this guy, said, look, I'm taking you to see Senator so-and-so. Don't open your mouth. I'll do all the talking.
Judicial nomination is a hot political issue today. I mean, sort of sub-Supreme Court been anticipating that. But I'd be fascinated to see someone sort of do an analytical study about what nominees were killed at what point in the process. It can be very obvious at the end when somebody's before the committee and there's no vote or there's a filibuster on the floor. But practices on moving a nomination vary by state and the conventions for, in the state with the senators and what the White House has agreed to. So you can have someone killed, really you've never heard about, because simply because Senator so-and-so won't return the papers. So I almost think the current nominations are getting further through the process before some of them being stopped. We saw an awful lot, and it varies over time. At the end of the Clinton administration, I mean, people, we were told, no, it's just not going to happen. Maybe well qualified. Mm-mm, no way. So I've got some different views on the current crisis of nominations in the judicial process.
I might go back to who was the editor of the Law Review in law school, and who wasn't.
Yeah.
But I've had that very thing come up.
I think I'd one more. Karen? Okay.
I have so many questions. Anyway, I wanna. I heard three chiefs of staff named so far in the discussion. I think Leon Panetta and Erskine Bowles, as well as John Sununu. Could I ask more generally, what was the relationships between legislative affairs and the chief of staff's office? And along with that, to what extent was the chief of staff fairly strongly involved in congressional liaison himself? That is, in actually meeting with members of Congress and lobbying members of Congress on particular pieces of legislation.
Well, I'll quickly do the two, since I mentioned both Leon and Erskine. Is Leon, of course, a creature of the House, an expert on the budget, so he was totally involved, engaged in a lot of the lobbying efforts, integral to those. And the coordination with his staff was always good. He brought his House Budget Committee and House staff down with him, which we all knew through the years. And so it was a very, very easy mix to work with them, and they were very, very well integrated. Erskine was a different kettle of fish, which is he had served, in an administrative position as deputy chief of staff before coming back to be chief of staff. And so he tended to delegate more and leave it sort of to the troops. But whenever we needed him to do anything, he actually liked to see the members, liked to go up there, but he was much, much less hands-on than Leon. But in both cases, like I said, marvelous bosses in the sense that they appreciated our function, gave us wide latitude and were incredibly supportive throughout. I mean, so like I say, I couldn't have been luckier.
I'd say John was very active on Capitol Hill, and I knew about it about 95-98% of the time. one of the great privileges of this job, or at least the way I tried to do it, was you also were able to develop very close relationships with many members of Congress, not just in the leadership, but folks throughout Congress, and they would also and oftentimes be your friend. In the sense that they'd call up and they'd go, Fred, you wouldn't believe what so-and-so said when so-and-so called me today. So, you know, it was one of these things where it was sort of a two-way street in the sense that I could get information which was then useful for me in terms of my ability to serve the president and do my job internally. I think chiefs of staff can be very, very valuable because I guess I had a briefly, I had a couple, but I also experienced some others when I've worked previously in the Reagan administration. It's like sort of any personal service kind of business. You know, you just hope that the folks didn't break so much china that you couldn't go in and repair it. Rather than members of Congress yelling at me, I let John yell at them. And it created a circumstance where if their usefulness finally sort of came to an end, as it did, as what happened to John at the end of the president's administration, President Bush's administration, it sort of comes back in roots. And so John had to stop doing it, and for whatever those reasons might have been. And our big job is to just make sure we can keep the kind of relationship that's necessary to be able to do the job on behalf of the president, and you use whatever resources you can. And I think chiefs of staff can be extremely valuable in that regard, and sometimes they can be destructive.
I worked for six chiefs of staff. The first one was H.R. Haldeman. Haldeman would never go to the Hill, and he was rather disdainful of Congress. In the final days of Watergate, when the ship was sinking, he wanted to go to the Hill and meet some congressman, and I took him up there, and he was apprehensive on the way, but he made a nice presentation. Of course, it was too late then. We were in extremis terminal, and I think if he had started out like a Jim Baker or a Dick Cheney, it could have been a whole different story. But Haldeman was not a congressional person. The second chief of staff I worked for was Al Haig, and he took over after Haldeman was indicted and resigned. Haig was in kind of a position of being up to his waist in alligators, and really that was just a holding pattern. Haig was swamped by the Watergate and the Vietnam crises that were going on. Then, of course, after Nixon resigned, Ford came in, and our first chief of staff was Rumsfeld. And, of course, that was like going from night to day. He was a great chief of staff, very knowledgeable, and wasn't too long before he departed for the, and did a lot of work on the Hill. Before he departed rather suddenly for the Defense Department, and Dick Cheney took over. And up until that time, Cheney would be the best chief of staff I worked for. He was thorough, efficient, ran an open shop, access to the president, very knowledgeable on the Hill and the issues, just a gem of a chief of staff. Then after we left office in the Ford administration, came back in the Reagan administration, the first chief of staff I worked for was Jim Baker, and I rate him as tops among all of them I ever worked for. He ran a real tight ship, access to the president. He would go to the Hill frequently. He would always ask me to accompany him, and he was just a tremendous lobbyist for the president. He never had an agenda of his own. We would go in and present the options to the president and the Hill sentiment, and he would give it to him unvarnished, never with any bias or prejudice. Succeeding Jim, him and Don Regan swapped jobs at the in the the start of the second term of Reagan, and I went back to the White House, and Don Regan had an entirely different agenda. He thought he was president, and Reagan was a retired, semi-retired president of the board. Don Regan cut off access to the president by the senior staff. We had to do everything through him. He had very poor relations with the Congress. I was telling, I think it was Larry at lunch, the first time Don and I went to the Hill, he wanted me to set up a meeting with the Senate leadership, Bob Dole and his team, and the committee chairman in the Senate. We went up, and Don spent about 45 minutes lecturing them on what he expected the Senate to do. And the senators hardly got a word in edgewise. And when I got back down to the office, I had a call from Bob Dole, and the receiver was burning in my ear. He said, "Don't ever come back up here with that kind of a presentation." Don had some great qualities. He was organized, of course, and he was not a politician. He aggravated the Congress, and he aggravated people on the staff, and it was unfortunate that him and Baker had switched jobs. I wasn't there during the Duberstein, who else, Howard Baker, so I can't comment on those. I'd be interested in what Will has to say.
It's interesting to have a former Senate Majority Leader as the Chief of Staff. But Howard Baker, of course, was enjoyed the President's complete confidence, and was able to deal with the Congress, and especially the Senate, like few Chiefs of Staff. And yet understood completely the importance of this, the position we're discussing today, and was very careful to make sure that communications were tight and well connected. And so at any rate, he was a tremendous asset to the President at a very critical time. Now, Howard, I can tell the story on him. He didn't like giving, as many chiefs of staff don't like to be the ones to give the President bad news. And I remember the day when the House had passed a highway bill that was old 15 or 20 billion over the budget by a huge majority. The Senate had passed it overwhelmingly.
Oh, this is.
And Howard said, it's time for us to talk to the President about that. Highway bill. I kept putting this off. It was my distant hope that this would be somehow signed without a whole lot of fanfare, despite the strong objections of the budget director. But anyway, the day came, we had to go. And I remember we walked in at the old office, and Senator Baker said, Mr. President, Will has some news. Will has some news to give you on the highway bill. So I cleared my throat and said, well, Mr. President, this highway bill has passed the House and the Senate. It's substantially over your budget request, which, of course, I tried to say happens a lot, Mr. President. And, but, sir, we've informed the leadership that your advisors, if it's sent to your desk in its current form, that your advisors would recommend a veto. And there's a long pause, and I said, Mr. President, I have to say that we've gone over this very carefully, and, sir, should you choose to veto this bill, I frankly can see no earthly way that we can gain the votes to ensure that your veto is sustained. And there was a long pause. But it was kind of a real Ronald Reagan moment. He looked at me and said, well, what on earth does that have to do with it? Period. So the die was cast. He was going to veto that bill no matter what. And did so. And so we had to make a stand. And didn't even attempt to sustain that in the House, and did so in the Senate. And that was a very tough effort, Max. You don't, you hit, Max had left the scene by then. But anyway, we lost, but only by 2 votes.
That's pretty good.
But it was a tough, but the point, I think on, I think on a domestic spending issue like this, presidents over time have tended to let Congress have their way on some domestic issues, but this is one that's stuck in Reagan's craw. Because it had been, of course, dealt with in the same way that the Corps of Engineers we were talking about earlier. but it was a, it was a trademark of throughout Reagan's term that, you know, if he staked out a principle, he was his comment to me was, you know, he felt strongly about the budget for domestic spending that year. And he was going to hold the line and attempt to send a signal. And I think that did serve his interest further that legislative year when it at least was known that he would pull out the veto pen. And that's a critical part of the authority of the Office of the Presidency, which if not exercised, tends to be overlooked.
We've already run well over it.
Just one. All right. One more. Okay. It's related to a veto, an issue that's still current, so I won't mention it. But towards the end of the administration, there was a bill that had pluses and minuses, and really, I remember sitting with the Secretary of Treasury, you know, Chief of Staff, saying, is this a good bill or is it a bad bill? Well, there are some pluses and there's some minuses. So we didn't know if we would veto it if it came to us. But the folks on the Hill didn't know if we would veto it, if it came to us or not. And they never sent it. They never called our bluff, because they didn't know what was going to happen. And to this day, I don't think any of us know what we would have done.
Well, I think we're off to a fabulous start. We've got a long day tomorrow. I appreciate your patience in letting us keep you a little bit long this afternoon. We're supposed to gather again at the Boar's Head at 6 for a reception, so that'll give you about an hour to get out there and relax a few minutes before we have an enjoyable evening off the record together.
Can we leave this material right here?
Yes, you may.
We'll be here tomorrow.
We'll begin again in this room tomorrow. I may reorganize the seating just a little bit to account for the people who are going to be leading, but other than that, you can leave stuff here. So, thank you.
Thank you.